Now the life of Joseph goes on, and we get to continue that journey this morning. Amazing journey of Joseph's life. It unfolds perhaps in even more unforgettable ways as we go to Genesis chapter 41 this morning. And so I would invite you to turn there and just keep our minds active. We'll say more about it in a minute. Really, two primary areas of focus. The first is two dreams. Two dreams that the Pharaoh of Egypt has, and then his pursuit of finding an interpretation for those, and how Joseph enters into that picture. And then second, all of these significant changes that come into Joseph's life. He's had some significant ones already, from being a favored son to a slave and then into prison, but there are just more that occur as he gets involved in the interpretation of these dreams. And I realize this is a lengthy chapter. If you flip a page, most likely you'll have to do that. But I do intend at various times to read through a majority of it this morning. And just throughout that time, look for biblical principles that we would say, you know, that's instructive for us approximately 3,800 years later. And yet, it is valid. It's biblical truth. Now, the initial portion of the chapter that I'm going to read is from verse 1 through verse 14 this morning. When 2 full years had passed, Pharaoh had a dream. He was standing by the Nile when out of the river there came up 7 cows, sleek and fat, and they grazed among the reeds. After them, 7 other cows, ugly and gaunt, came up out of the Nile and stood beside those on the riverbank. And the cows that were ugly and gaunt ate up the 7 sleek, fat cows. Then Pharaoh woke up. He fell asleep again and had a second dream. 7 heads of grain, healthy and good, were growing on a single stalk. After them, 7 other heads of grains, heads of grain sprouted thin and scorched by the east wind. The thin heads of grain swallowed up the 7 healthy full heads. Then Pharaoh woke up. It had been a dream. In the morning, his mind was troubled. So he sent for all the magicians and wise men of Egypt. Pharaoh told them his dreams, but no one could interpret them for him. Then the chief cupbearer said to Pharaoh, "Today I am reminded of my shortcomings. Pharaoh was once angry with his servants, and he imprisoned me and the chief baker in the house of the captain of the guard. Each of us had a dream the same night, and each dream had a meaning of its own. Now a young Hebrew was there with us, a servant of the captain of the guard. We told him our dreams, and he interpreted them for us, giving each man the interpretation of his dream. And things turned out exactly as he interpreted them to us. I was restored to my position, and the other man was hanged." So Pharaoh sent for Joseph, and he was quickly brought from the dungeon. When he had shaved and changed his clothes, he came before Pharaoh. Well, you know, when you conclude chapter 40, and if you're recalling what transpired there, we just build upon that because it just says 2 years had passed, and so you have to understand. It's been 2 years since Joseph had interpreted dreams of 2 men. But before we look at this new dream, I do want to look at that very first phrase of verse 1. The way the Hebrew phrases it would be quite interesting. It doesn't show up in the English text. And here's how it literally flows. "And it came to pass at the end of 2 years' days." Kind of an awkward statement, not 2 years of days. And 2 years obviously would pass day by day. That's just the way it's stated. It's quite different from the generalized statement that occurs a couple of times in verse 40 or chapter 40, sometime later or after some time. It's very specific. I think it's saying a couple of things. I think it appears to emphasize that at the extremity or cutoff point of 2 years' time, which has passed day by day. Now, I think that could possibly mean that we are again on or very near the birthday of Pharaoh, because that's the latter part of chapter 40, and it's saying 2 years to the very extremity, to the very end of those has passed. And if that is true, that timing could have had significant bearing on the cupbearer's recollection of Joseph's interpretation of his dream, because that would have been 2 years previously. And yet the construction of the phrase could also convey that this had been a long 2 years for Joseph, passing minute by minute and hour by hour and day by day. And I believe both of those are really accurate perspectives. And if the latter particularly is true, that time has really been seemingly going slow, well, that's about to change. Things will be different. Pharaoh has two dreams. Relative close proximity of time, same night. They involve a group of cows, seven in each group, two groups, and two groups of the heads of grain. Again, seven in each. You know, having grown up on the farm, those particular subjects for dreams are not all that unusual. I mean, they're just a part of a farmer's life. Cattle and livestock and crop. Yet of specific interest, I think, is the context for Pharaoh and the activity that occurs, obviously, and with the cows and with the grain. In the words of H.C. Leupold in his Genesis commentary, Egypt was known as the granary of the ancient world. 7 ears on a stalk were not at all uncommon. These seen in the dream were so plump, literally fat, that it was a pleasure to behold them. Now the second group of seven heads of grain was not only thin, what does it tell? They're scorched by the east wind? Well, this is a description of weather phenomena in Egypt, I think best understood by this comment. A phenomenon of Egypt's climate is the hot spring wind that blows across the country. The winds known to Europeans as the Scirocco and to Egyptians as the Khamsin usually arrive in April, but occasionally occur in March and May. The winds form in a small but vigorous low-pressure area in the Isthmus of Suez and sweep across the northern coast of Africa. Unobstructed by geographical features, the winds reach high velocities and carry great quantities of sand and dust from the deserts. These sandstorms, often accompanied by winds up to 140 kilometers an hour, and if you translate, that's 86 miles an hour, can cause temperatures to rise, get this, as much as 20 degrees centigrade, 35 degrees Fahrenheit, in 2 hours. That's a significant change. The winds blow intermittently and may continue for days, cause illness in people and animals, harm crops, and occasionally damage houses and infrastructure. And so it was this second group of heads of grain who already are thin, and then this east wind scorches them that devour the earlier group. Now that would catch your attention, more than just dreaming about crops. Well, what about the cows? Consider this information by Caroline Seawright. particles, animals, and the gods of ancient Egypt. Hathor, Isis, Nuit, and Bat were goddesses who were often depicted as cows, with the horns of cows or with the ears of cows. Because of this, and because of the relationship of the Pharaoh as a living god, the cow came to symbolize the mother of the Pharaoh. The cow was also a solar icon where Nuit carried the sun across the sky on her back when she was in cow form. And so this part of the dream, which occurred first, was probably more disturbing to Pharaoh than the prominence of the grain because of the theological belief system that he had. We could consider all kinds of things about that. And the fact that there was a similar message, apparently, although he didn't know the interpretation, seven good, seven bad, and seven good and seven bad, and the bad eating up the good. It's not surprisingly that what we find in verse 8 is said. It says he was disturbed. He was troubled. These things bothered him. The idea is they're turmoiling, turning over in his mind as he brings these thoughts back and back and back again to the dream. So he attempts to find an interpretation, and he's unsuccessful. And it's in that context that the cupbearer recalls his experience. And I think when he says that, what's the actual wording? He phrases it, his misgivings or shortcomings. He's not thinking that he failed Joseph, that he's just thinking from his own terminology. He's thinking of his time that he ended up in prison and why. But this prompts his mind. And hearing what he says about Joseph, why, Pharaoh seems to summon this man immediately. Now, one can only imagine Joseph's thoughts as he's told that Pharaoh wants you. Maybe gains a little bit of time as he's prepped physically of why he is being summoned. And so if you've had 2 years that go by day, then something is going to dramatically change. And we'll look at that in a little bit. But I want to make a little bit more of a thought process. You know, in Genesis 39 and 40, although that's a large period of time itself, there seems to be real critical evidence of God's active and personal and sovereign care and involvement in Joseph's life. And I'm probably certain that because of the length of time, there were some times when that was more obvious to Joseph than not. But what I think is really stressed at the beginning of chapter 1 is that even when there is an absence of that being observable, it's still true. God is still as much at work for His purposes. Now, the evidence may seem less and the days may drag along, but He is still as much at work, which is different from just the mere appearance. You know, Philippians chapter 2, I think, emphasizes this fact when it states, "Therefore, my dear friends, as you have always obeyed, not only in my presence, but now much more in my absence, continue to work out your salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you to will and to act according to His good purpose." That's true all the time, whether we recognize it or not. Let's return to Genesis chapter 41, now at verse 15. Pharaoh said to Joseph, because he stands now in front of him, Joseph in front of Pharaoh, "I had a dream, and no one can interpret it. But I have heard it said that you, that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. I cannot do it, Joseph replied. But God will give Pharaoh the answer he desires. Now, Joseph makes a similar statement in chapter 40, I believe. But the wording here is a little more direct, I think, in the statement of his faith and his belief that God will do this. And I think particularly in acknowledging that he cannot do this. And so the first thing Joseph states to Pharaoh is that when it comes to an interpretation, that's going to happen apart from himself. I cannot do it. He is merely the means through which God is going to do something that only God himself can do. Now, perhaps it would appear just to be a minor difference in emphasis between what's stated in 40 and 41. And yet I think it gives an indication that Joseph's faith continues to develop and deepen. Yeah, even when it was day after day with no apparent evidence that God was at work. In the words of John the Baptist, which he said about Jesus, he must increase and I must decrease. So Joseph seeks to draw Pharaoh's expectations away from himself and place them upon God. And because God is the one that will give the answer, the result is that God will bring peace to Pharaoh's troubled mind. Because literally the word desires is the Hebrew word shalom. Peace. God's answer, provided through the interpretation that Joseph is going to give, will cause that strife and that turmoil in Pharaoh's heart to cease. And as believers in Christ, we have strong promises of peace that are given to us. 1 Peter 5:7, cast all your anxiety on Him because He cares for you, with the implication that peace will come. And then Philippians 4, 6, and 7, do not be anxious about anything, but in everything by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God, and the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Now, the peace that Pharaoh will experience, I think, comes because the interpretation is given. And then following that, there will be an offering and then an implementation of a plan that will meet the challenges that these dreams reveal will come in the years ahead. And we're not going to read Pharaoh's relating of his dreams back to Joseph, so let's skip down to verse 25. As Joseph interprets these dreams. And Joseph said to Pharaoh, the dreams of Pharaoh are one and the same. Now God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good heads of grain are 7 years. It is one and the same dream. The seven lean, ugly cows that came up afterward are 7 years, and so are the seven worthless heads of grain scorched by the east wind. There are 7 years of famine. It is just as I said to Pharaoh, God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. 7 years of great abundance are coming throughout the land of Egypt, but 7 years of famine will follow them. Then all the abundance of Egypt will be forgotten, and the famine will ravage the land. The abundance in the land will not be remembered, because the famine that follows it will be so severe. The reason the dream was given to Pharaoh in two forms is that the matter has been firmly decided by God, and God will do it soon. So he interprets the dream. I think it highlights the duplication that has come as a part of that, and it gives the emphasis that I think that duplication is means to convey. And then I think it also is intended, what Joseph shares to remind Pharaoh, considered as a god, that he is not sovereign. And that really is in the wording in verse 28, where it says, God has shown, we could say, God has caused Pharaoh to see what God is about to do. Now, the form of the verb indicates that Pharaoh can't find this on his own. He's incapable on his own of coming to that. And even through the expertise of all his magicians and his wise men, he's the recipient, but he's not the cause. The other point, I think, of emphasis is that regardless of what level of abundance they will experience, and it will be significant, then during the latter 7 years, there's going to be extreme difficulty. Kind of rereading a couple of verses there. The abundance will be forgotten, verse 30, and the land ravaged, literally, it will be done in, would be a good translation, and the abundance, verse 31, will not be remembered, and the famine will be severe. It'll be grievous, it'll be heavy, which is the same word that in the praise of God is the word for glory. A weighty thing, but in a negative perspective. I do find it interesting that God respects Pharaoh's position by giving him this dream, and not to someone else in his entourage. And I think that concept is explained a little bit more in verse 25, that God has graciously laid this clearly before Pharaoh. He says, the dreams of Pharaoh are one and the same, and God has revealed. That's where you put something out in real prominence, where it can be seen, can be noticed. And God has done that. I think this God emphasizes that God is being very gracious to speak truth to Pharaoh. I think it'd be inaccurate to think that always, or even often, that God speaks so specifically about an impending difficulty. Now, we have cars, I guess, that do that now. And, you know, what warning? I've never ridden in one, but, you know, pretty soon they'll be telling us, you know, crash coming in 5 minutes or what, I don't know. But God was gracious in warning him of this impending difficulty. In this situation, it suited his sovereign purposes, I think, to disclose those details that will go 14 years in advance. And in a broader perspective, when the Scriptures warn about the consequences of sin, the wages of sin or death, for instance, and warn about eternal separation from God apart from Christ, those are gracious warnings. God is gracious in telling us the truth. Let's go back to the passage. Verse 33. This is Joseph's words now after the interpretation. Now let Pharaoh look for discerning and wise men and put him in charge of the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh appoint commissioners over the land to take a fifth of the harvest of Egypt during the 7 years of abundance. They should collect all the food of these good years that are coming and store up the grain under the authority of Pharaoh to be kept in the cities for food. This food should be held in reserve for the country to be used during the 7 years of famine that will come upon Egypt, so the country may not be ruined by the famine. The plan seemed good to Pharaoh and to all his officials. So Pharaoh asked, can we find anyone like this man, one in whom is the Spirit of God? Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has made all this known to you, there's no one so discerning and wise as you. You shall be in charge of my palace, and all my people are to submit to your orders. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you. And we're not told if there was a time gap between verse 32 and verse 33. And I would assume if there one was at all, it was brief. Just almost immediately after offering the interpretation, Joseph suggests a comprehensive response. I think this gives us a little bit of a picture into the skills that God has gifted Joseph with, and perhaps how he's honed those, and perhaps even to how his mind worked. When a challenge came, it just kind of kicked into gear of solving that or a plan to deal with it. And yet I think it's also a testimony to God's continued blessing in Joseph's life. I think that's Pharaoh's perspective when he states in verse 39, one in whom the Spirit of God abides. And in the words of H.C. Leupold, the commentator, the Spirit of God did more than merely enable Joseph to interpret the king's dream. He enabled him to furnish a comprehensive plan to meet this unusual emergency. And the plan is as masterful as was the interpretation that preceded it. Now, just a short time earlier, Joseph has come into Pharaoh's presence, we could say, as a maybe just temporarily released from prison. And now Pharaoh is ready to place him in the second highest position in all of Egypt. Wow. Wow. Now, the implications of that begin to unfold when we come to verse 41. Now, we'll get there in just a moment. Let's just stop and think for a little bit about Joseph's faith. He is so certain that God will give the interpretation to these dreams and that the interpretation is accurate and that will occur that he goes ahead and suggests the plan. That plan is ludicrous if you don't believe that God is in the interpretation. Because God has emphasized that these events will occur soon. Joseph certainly believes there's no time to delay. So that raises a question. Does our faith readily translate that quickly into action? It's one thing to say, I have faith and I believe God will do that. This translated into action. Now, certainly it was a unique situation and God is at work. And yet Joseph's response and his faith, I think, are a challenge to not only believe, but say I believe, and then take action that's appropriate to that belief. Secondly, I think we can see here the fuller picture of why God has placed Joseph in lesser situations of administration to sharpen his skills. Because Joseph now faces an enormous challenge regardless of his background. God has been taking his time. And I think developing these skills and the necessary experience as well that only comes through time. And that doesn't discount God's power to come and to give impetus and to make a significant difference or the wisdom that he promises to us. I think it just helps us to begin to understand those earlier years, actually 13 of them, from God's larger perspective. We need to thank God that sometimes he allows us an aha. Oh, now I see why God was leading me in that path. Joseph, I think, would have that moment. And so he can be trusted to work in our life, not just today, but in light of tomorrow, because he knows what tomorrow is. Thirdly, and I think this really sets the stage for moving forward here. Let's think about humility. I believe what we observed during the past 13 years of Joseph's life is that God has been at work nurturing humility. I wasn't there when we first meet Joseph, but I think it's there now. Here's H.C. Leupold's perspective. We feel very keenly that Joseph never for a moment thought of himself as a possible candidate for head administrator. Verse 16 shows how little Joseph thought of turning the situation to his own advantage. That's where he says, you're not going to find the interpretation with me. How utterly unreasonable for one who had never held an office of state, who beside was a foreigner and still almost smelled of the prison whence he had been brought, for such a one to anticipate immediate advancement to position second only to that of Pharaoh. That would have been more like the Joseph of Genesis 37. A little later, Leupold comments, only a man like Joseph, schooled by adversity and sorrow, could meet a sudden elevation like this without pride and self-exaltation. And if God is trying to work on humility in our lives, we should accept that. Because it probably relates to something in the past or something that's coming. As difficult as it is to learn humility, we should accept that. We're going to start reading again at verse 41. And we'll notice the number of changes from slave, then prisoner most immediately, and now almost unbridled freedom that Joseph will have. There's going to be an enormous change in not only position, but scope of responsibility. In time, he is going to be married, and then he'll have children in the next 7 years. And from an overall perspective, he'll go in 7 years of abundance. Now, wouldn't that be how you'd like to start your public service career? On a promise that the next 7 years will be wonderful? And then, of course, to manage in a time of increasing famine. So Pharaoh, verse 41, said to Joseph, I hereby put you in charge of the whole land of Egypt. Wow. Then Pharaoh took his signet ring from his finger and put it on Joseph's finger. He dressed him in robes of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. He had him ride in a chariot as his second in command, and men shouted before him, make way! Thus he put him in charge of the whole land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, I am Pharaoh, but without your word, no one will lift hand or foot in all of Egypt. You get the point it's saying things have changed? Pharaoh, verse 45, gave Joseph the name Zephanath-Paneah and gave him Asenath, daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, to be his wife. And Joseph went throughout the land of Egypt. Joseph was 30 years old when he entered the service of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and Joseph went out from Pharaoh's presence and traveled throughout Egypt. During the 7 years of abundance, the land produced plentifully. Joseph collected all the food produced in those 7 years of abundance in Egypt and stored it in the cities. In each city, he put the food grown in the fields surrounding it. Joseph stored up huge quantities of grain. Like the sand of the sea, it was so much that he stopped keeping records because it was beyond measure. Before the years of famine came, two sons were born to Joseph by Asenath, daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. Joseph named his firstborn Manasseh, and said, it is because God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household. The second son he named Ephraim, and said, it is because God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering. That's incredible. Things are now so good. Has Joseph forgotten all of his pain? And all that been erased from his memory? Well, absolutely not. But God has been gracious to him. And yet, the very dream of Joseph has not yet been fulfilled. Because in his dreams, it was family, not Egyptians, that bowed down to him. I would like to know what he's thinking, but we're not told. Let's read the rest of the story real quickly. Just as Joseph said, verse 57, the 7 years of abundance in Egypt came, and the 7 years of famine began, just as Joseph said. There was famine in all the other lands, but in the whole land of Egypt there was no food. When all Egypt began to feel the famine, the people cried to Pharaoh for food. Then Pharaoh told all the Egyptians, "Go to Joseph and do what he tells you." When the famine has spread over the whole country, Joseph opened the storehouses and sold grain to the Egyptians, for the famine was very severe. And all the countries came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph, because the famine was severe in all the land. The time doesn't allow me to really do justice to just some closing thoughts, but let me put them together. What about humility? If you take the backside of your bulletin, every week we put on the mission statement of the church. And then every week we subpoint some of that. The mission statement is to glorify God through honoring His name, teaching His word, loving His people, and expanding His kingdom. Well, it just so happens that this week's points of expansion state, we value loving relationships characterized by humility, honesty, accountability, forgiveness, and restoration. Humility is so important, not just in the life of a Joseph, but to have a healthy church family. Because it's not about us, it's about God. Yeah, He's gifted us with tremendous opinions and insight and abilities and perspectives. I think we can just think a long time about the value of humility. And so we state those on purpose. A second point. You know, when we think about God's sovereignty, and well, this is 3,800 years ago, and it's somebody else's life. This past week, I received two emails that are just examples. One came from Colombia. No, I don't mean Columbia, Missouri. I mean the country in South America. One of our church families, newer to the church, had been there. They were actually there in Bogota. A relative of theirs is planting a church. This family was exposed here to Awana, and they were talking about that with their now relative pastor who's planting the church in his home about children's ministry. And lo and behold, there is a Spanish version of Awana. You know, ministry that we've conducted for 30-plus years and probably go through the motions and sometimes. Now, God has sovereignly placed somebody in the club to take that message somewhere else. I think we just need to remind ourselves from time to time that God is just as sovereignly at work in our church family as in the life of Joseph. Now, it's not on that kind of a worldwide scheme, and it's not going to be written up in the Scriptures. Another one deals with one of our worker families who had to come home because of issues with their grown children. And God placed them in a community that now is being inundated of the same ethnic people that they had to leave to come home. And if you know the story, it happens to be where Pastor Tom Macy is now pastoring. Where Tom went with us on that second vision trip. You think God knows what He's doing? Of course He does. Finally, let me read this quotation from Donald Barnhouse. Just a reminder of the sovereignty of God, and with that I close. Do you not believe in the sovereignty of the general staff of the army? This was written probably right around the time of World War II. Our joint armies, American and British, were all waiting in England in 1944 for D-Day, and at that time, by common consent, one man had been chosen to say, "This is the day." And Eisenhower was in supreme and sovereign command. Nobody questioned his right to say this company shall go there and land under the emplacement and die. This one shall go there and do this. We recognize the right of a commanding general to say to one man, take this map and find this bridge. Take a parachute, fly over, drop down over the bridge and destroy it, and we will give your widow the Victoria Cross. And to another, that lorry over there is bogged down in the mud. Go and blister your hands and get it out. If a general can do this, please allow God Almighty to do what He wills. He knows what He is doing. He has a vital plan for all that is going on, and we are a part of it, although we do not know why. There were many men in the army who did not know where they were going, whether they would be sent to Norway, Greece, or anyone else. They recognized the right of their officers to send them where they would. And he closes with this phrase, shall we not recognize the right of God to be sovereign? Shall we pray? Lord, in one sense, that's a disturbing phrase because I want to fight with it. But could I be willing to acknowledge that You are sovereign and that You know what You're doing in my life? And You know what You're doing collectively in us as a church family. And so we do have a sense of real dependency and trust and submission and seeking You. And that can nurture humility. And that is such a healthy thing. So Lord, thank You for displaying who You are through the life of Joseph on our behalf. I pray in Christ's name.